Thank you very much, Mary. Everybody having a good time tonight?
Yeah.
Everybody enjoy that dinner?
Yeah.
You know, we're doing something absolutely amazing here tonight. We're treating a fatal illness. What a treatment it is. It's amazing things of over a thousand years of sobriety here tonight. But I saw something even more amazing than that. There's a handsome young man over here with 19 days of sobriety who can tie a tie. That's amazing. I couldn't tie a tie when I was 19 days. My name is Bill Sanders, and I am an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight. And that will be the most important thing that I will tell you this evening. That it is by the grace of a loving God and through the fellowship of rooms like this that this alcoholic is sober and happy and joyous and free tonight. I love being a miracle. And I like being in the company of miracles. When I first came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, during those foggy few days and weeks, I heard a lot of talk about an alcoholic personality. And I began to ask people, because you see, I really wasn't sure that I belonged with you people at all. Matter of fact, I was darn sure that I didn't. So I said, what is an alcoholic personality? And I got long, involved descriptions, none of which made any sense to me whatsoever. Until somewhere along the way, an old-timer said, son, sit down, let me tell you a little story that will tell you what an alcoholic personality is. And you may have heard this story before, but if you have, you're going to hear it again. It's the story of a little drunk walking along the beach one day. Stumbling through the sand, he stumbles upon a bottle half buried in the sand, and he pulls it out, picks the bottle up and looks at it, and reaches up to uncork it in hopes of finding a few stray drops in the bottom. He hadn't had a drink in nearly a day. As he uncorked it, there was no smell of alcohol. There was a puff of smoke. And in a second, standing before him in the sand was a great big fellow with a turban on his head. Now, this little fellow had had bad DTs, but he'd never seen anything like this. The fellow looked down at the little drunk and said, I am your genie. You have three wishes. What would you like? And the little fellow sighed, and he thought for a minute, and he said, I'd like to have a bottle of bourbon that's never empty. Another puff of smoke in an instant in the sand there was in front of him, a jug. He uncorked it and took one whiff. It was right to the top of the jug. And it was the good stuff. He took a sip. He knew it was the good stuff. He took a good slug of it. And he looked at it. It was still right to the top of the bottle. He tilted it back and chugged at it for about 30 seconds. More than he'd had in 3 days. Tilted the bottle down and looked, and it was still right to the top. The genie says, Master, is that all right? He said, that's wonderful. He said, you have two more wishes. What would you like? He said, I want two more just like that one. That's an alcoholic personality. And if you understand that story, you're in the right place tonight. Because I'm going to tell you something. You go out here on I-85 or on the streets of Montgomery and you tell that story to some of those people walking along out there and they'll look at you real strange and say, well, if it's never going to be empty, why would he want... You know, they don't understand. They don't understand us. I understood that story and I understood an alcoholic personality and it was the beginning of the dawning that I might be in the right place. I had my first drink of alcohol at the age of 15. But my story really has to go back a little before that. I was born in a little town in the hills of North Georgia. Little town, little bitty town. I used to say on Saturday night there were three things you could do in that little town I grew up in. You could watch them unload the truck at the A&P. You could watch the water tank leak. Or you could go across the Savannah River into South Carolina and buy alcohol and drink. I did not arrive at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous from too much water tank watching. It was a typical little North Georgia small town. And in a lot of ways, I outwardly appeared to be a typical kid in that town, the ages of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. But I don't think I was. You see, when I came to you people, I told you that I had been drinking alcoholically for 2 or 3 years. Amazingly, the longer I'm here, the further back that goes. So tonight I can tell you I believe with everything in me that I was born an alcoholic. At the age of 15, I became a drunk. And it took until I was almost 40 to become just an alcoholic again. But you see, even as a little kid, with the outward appearance of everything is A-OK, inside there was nothing but holy terror, afraid of people, a feeling that I never belonged anywhere I was. I never fit in. But I couldn't tell anybody that. At the age of 15, under peer pressure, curiosity, or for whatever other reasons, I joined a group of friends who one Saturday night said, "Let's go across to South Carolina and buy some beer." And I said, "Okay." And I got in the car with them and took the 25-mile ride over to South Carolina, and we bought a case of beer and came back and sat on the banks of the Savannah River. I can't go back to where I had my first drink. I'd like to, but it's about 150 feet underwater in Lake Hartwell. But back then it was just the Savannah River. And I had my first swallow of beer. Most god-awful, vile-tasting, putrid stuff I had ever put in my mouth. I mean, the first swallow got to here and came back up to here, got to here, came back up to here. I finally got it to stay down. It was awful. Only drank 6 of them that night. Somewhere between the second and the third beer, something happened. The scared little boy inside wasn't scared anymore. The terror went away. I became glib, funny, romantic, exciting. I was sure that I was every bit of Clark Gable. I like what that stuff did. And even if it tasted that bad, it was worth it. I learned to like it. You know, for the next 20-some-odd years that I drank, I assumed that everybody that ever drank, drank for the same reasons that I did. I didn't drink for the taste, didn't like it. I didn't drink to relax. Well, I got relaxed all right. I got drunk the first time I ever drank. I got drunk virtually every time that I ever drank after that. I drank for the feeling. I drank for the change that it made inside of me. It took away those fears and the anxiety and the pain, and it made me feel like I fit in anywhere I went. I didn't drink all that much as a kid in high school simply because it wasn't all that much available. And it was frowned on, and everybody knows everybody else's business in a little town like that. They're more Baptist than anything else, and you know what they say? It's a sign of changing times when the Baptists start speaking to each other at the liquor store. Well, there weren't any liquor stores in Hartwell, Georgia back then. Still aren't, I don't think. As far as I know, they're not. That doesn't mean it's not available. At any rate, I drank moderately in amount, if not in excess when I was drinking, through high school. And then I went away to college. And when I went the 57 miles over to Athens, Georgia to go to school, I made a big cultural first geographic change because suddenly I was going to school at a university whose population was over twice that of my whole hometown. And I had my first taste of anonymity. Because at the University of Georgia, nobody cared how much little Billy Sanders drank. Nobody paid any attention to how much he drank. And so I started drinking every day. There are a lot of people who have wonderful, happy memories of their college careers. I'm not one of those people. Thank goodness I have some fond memories of college. But for the most part, it's rather foggy, rather hazy. Because I cut classes and barely got by that first year till I began to figure out the system and how I could work around it. I found out some interesting things while I was at the University of Georgia about that great college university. They weren't very patriotic over there. Because I almost got thrown out of school for singing the Star Spangled Banner to an empty flagpole in front of the college infirmary or hospital at 3 o'clock in the morning. I also had a lot of school spirit. I liked to ring the University of Georgia chapel bell, a great tradition at the university, but not at 3 o'clock in the morning on Easter Sunday. They don't like that. Almost threw me out again. Matter of fact, outside of Dean Bill Tate, the Dean of Men at the University of Georgia's office, there was a bench referred to as the Bill Sanders bench, because I sat on it more than anybody else in that school. God love her. Dean Tate's secretary, all she had to do is look up, stand up from her desk, walk over to the dean's office and say, "He's here again." And he knew who was here. That's when a real alcoholism began to take over and the alcoholic behavior and drinking really kicked into full gear. That I know today. In the junior year of my college career, I got the dream that every student in the particular school of the University of Georgia that I was in had. And that's an opportunity to intern in my chosen profession in Atlanta. I didn't tell you that at the age of 13, I got into the profession that I've been in for the last almost 35 years, and that's the broadcasting business. At one time, supposedly, I was supposed to be the youngest disc jockey in the country, and that was a detriment to me in trying to tell people what was going inside of me, because I'd sit down before the microphone in the afternoon during my radio program, and this glib character would come out on the air that everybody assumed was who Bill Sanders is. That was somebody else. That was an alter ego. That was hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone. Inside was still the pain and the anxiety of that scared little kid. But finally, as a junior in college, I got the opportunity to go to work for a summer as an intern at the big 50,000-watt clear channel Voice of the South, WSB in Atlanta. A dream that I'd had since I was 13. As fate would have it, both my roommate and I got the only two internships that were available that summer in that profession at that great station. And on a spring day of that year, we went down to Atlanta and living on top of the world, we borrowed a car from a friend and we went down and made arrangements for our housing for the summer, found a little apartment to live in, went by the station, met the people we'd be working with, got all set up to start to work in a few weeks. And we decided before we headed back to Athens, we'd have a few drinks. We stopped at a bar and had a few and a few more and a few more. And finally headed back over to Athens and got back and returned the car to the friend that we had borrowed it from and decided at his apartment to have a few more drinks and celebrate our great, wonderful success, our dream come true, living top of the world. And as I was prone to do when I started getting to that point of no return in drinking, I got to clowning around and acting like a total idiot. I reached over on the wall and took down an old antique pistol that was in a whole display of antique artillery on the wall of this fellow's apartment. And I began waving it around in the air, and I pointed it at my roommate and said, "Stick 'em up." He threw his hands up in mock surrender. And I pulled the trigger. And there was a sound like thunder. And in a moment, my roommate was lying on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. A few hours later at the local hospital, they were to tell us that Wayne would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet had severed his spine. In the wee hours of the morning in that hospital room, a very strange thing happened. My roommate looked up at me from the hospital bed and he took me by the hand and he said, "It's okay, Bill. I know you didn't mean to do it. Please don't blame yourself. Please don't." Wayne forgave me immediately. But I didn't forgive me for more than 20 years. I used it as an excuse to beat myself up, to crawl into a bottle, to isolate from the world, and to hide. That summer, I came on to WSB in Atlanta, and my roommate came to Piedmont Hospital for surgery after surgery after surgery in vain attempt to try to restore the use of his legs. It was unfortunately not to happen. And I would get up, go to work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I would work through the evening until the 11 o'clock news. And when we'd finish the 11 o'clock news at night, I'd go across the street to what was a local bar and a local hotel across the street. And I'd start drinking. And I would drink till 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning. As long as there was somebody there that I could drink with and talk with. The bartender would pour me into a cab and I'd stumble home, sleep it off until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then begin the whole cycle all over again. The summer that was to have been a dream, the summer that was to have been the greatest of my life, turned into a never-ending nightmare. And today it's a drunken haze, unfortunately. That fall, I was back in school at the university. And the cycle of going to work and drinking and going to work and drinking came to an end, and I was back in the old familiar surroundings. And I felt I couldn't take it any longer. And I began to set my plans. I went to the college infirmary and I told the doctors I was having trouble sleeping. They had three doctors in the infirmary, and I'd go to one day, one the next day, and one the next day. And I told each one I was having trouble sleeping and could they give me something to help me sleep. And all three were prescribing pretty heavy-duty sleeping pills. And about a week later, I'd go back to all three to get them refilled again until I amassed what I thought was enough. And then I waited until a Friday afternoon until my new roommate was headed home for the weekend. And I stood in the dormitory window and I watched his car pull out of the parking lot. And when it did, I pulled down the shades, sat down on the side of the bed and took all the little bottles and poured them out on the nightstand. Took a glass of water and drank down what was later determined to be 50-some-odd sleeping pills and turned out the light and pulled up the cover. For over 20 years, I thought that it was a huge coincidence that my roommate's car broke down at the city limits of Athens and had to be towed back, and he came back into that dormitory room and found those empty bottles and put two and two together pretty quickly. I thought it was a coincidence. Today I don't believe in coincidences. I love the definition I heard some years ago. A coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. I believe today that that was one of the first times of many when the loving God that you people introduced to me said, "Big boy, I'm not through with you yet." It was after that incident that I began the great American tradition of visiting the friendly psychiatrist and psychologist. And for over 20 years, I went to an awful lot of those people, spent a lot of money, and damned them every time I went because they didn't help me a bit. Now, in their defense, I have to say they might have been able to help me if I had ever once told them the truth. Somewhere about the second, third, or fourth question, they always say, "Do you think you might have a drinking problem?" And my answer was, "No, I drink fine." And they go off treating something else. I finally graduated from the University of Georgia. I think they may have just gotten tired of me and run me off. I don't know. But at least they gave me a diploma. And eventually I ended up in another town in North Georgia working in a radio station. And in that town I met a beautiful young girl and quickly fell in love and got married. I made a decision when I got married that I was going to straighten my act up some. I drank too much, and I needed to do something about that. But thank goodness I found out I didn't have to, because she liked to drink just as much as I did. We joined a local club there, and I got involved in all kinds of things in the community, taught Sunday school classes, and did everything else to look like the pillar of the community. But we joined a local club where we could go to at about 5:30 every afternoon after we'd get off work. And we'd stay there till it closed about 1 o'clock in the morning. Drinking all the way. Then I had to get up and go to work at 5:30 in the morning. Now, you want to know what hell is, I'm going to tell you. Hell is trying to sound cheerful to a radio audience at 6 o'clock in the morning when the top of your head's coming off and your mouth tastes like the bottom of a bird cage. It was then that I first learned to pray. Thank you, God, that this ain't television. I would never have pulled it off. My wife and I were at that club almost every night, week in and week out. And a few years later, my wife says, "Guess what? I'm pregnant." And we talked about it and decided that when the baby came, we were going to both have to do something about our drinking and become responsible parents. And we talked about it a lot. We talked about it a whole lot more than we did it. We did it for about 2 or 3 weeks till we discovered the great American tradition of the babysitter. And then we just had an added expense while we went to the club every night. It was then, I know today, that that marriage to that first wife of mine began coming apart at the seams. There are those who arrive at the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous who say that with their spouse, they had a communications problem. My wife and I had no communications problem whatsoever. You could ask our neighbors 4 doors down the street and they'd tell you, "The Sanders communicate. We can hear them every night." And there was something about back then that I can admit today that I couldn't back then, and that is I had a pattern. When I get in one of my communication sessions with my wife, I'd hang in there full blast as long as I was winning. But if I started losing, I had a typical pattern I'd follow. I'd get in the car, take off. One Sunday afternoon, we got into one of our discussions that I think was heard about 6 doors down the street. And somehow, I don't even remember what it was we were discussing, but somehow I started losing. And I did what I usually did. I grabbed my bottle. I stormed out of the house, got in my car, squealed out of the driveway, and took off up the street. The only thing wrong this particular Sunday afternoon is I happened to be in my pajamas. That little first wife of mine, she was a sweetie. She did what any sweet, loving, caring, thoughtful, adoring wife would do. She called somebody to go get her husband and bring him home. Only thing wrong with that, the fellow she called happened to be a police captain and a good family friend. Well, the police captain finally caught up with me in the parking lot of the Holiday Inn, sitting there calmly talking to my bottle, not bothering anybody. He suggested I might want to come with him, and he's going to take me home. I told him he could. I said, no, I'd rather not. Something like that. He kept talking and explaining to me about his Marine Corps career and his relative size to mine and the length of that billy club he had on his side, and it began to make some sense that I go with him. I mean, I was drunk, but I wasn't crazy. And I got in the car with him, and I knew in about two corners that we turned, we weren't going to my house. The next thing I knew, we were pulling into the parking lot of the emergency room of the hospital. And he had me by the arm and led me inside. And before I knew it, I was upstairs in the hospital, checked in. You won't believe how fast you can get checked into a hospital when you've already got your pajamas on. They don't want you sitting around the lobby that way. Then a strange little thing happened that was to aid and abet my denial for a lot of years. You see, when I came to this fellowship, I told you people that I had never been put in a hospital for my drinking like a lot of you had said you had. I said, well, that never happened to me. I had a whole bunch of I nevers when I got here. Whole string of them. They were a part of what my sponsor referred to as my other illness. He said, your damn terminal uniqueness. Well, anyway, that Sunday afternoon, my wife and my doctor and my police captain friend, and I don't know who else was in on it, got a little powwow together and said, when Abel's on the radio every day, and if we put him down there in detox, it's going to be out on the street before you know it, and the paper'd love to get a hold of it and put it in the front page tomorrow. So what we'll do is we'll put him in a regular room in the other part of the hospital, and we'll put a clipboard on the door that says he's in here for strep throat, and nobody will know but us. And 10 or 12 days later, when I checked out of that hospital, I was convinced I had been cured of strep throat. And you know what? I held on to that till I had to write that damn fourth step, and the truth came out. That and a lot of other things came out then. Well, finally, my wife and I ended up taking... Oh, by the way, of course, I didn't stay sober. I was drunk before nightfall the day I got out of the hospital. By then, our little girl was about 2 years old. And I'd missed most of her first 2 years. She knew the babysitters a whole lot more than she knew her parents. We took a geographical cure and moved back to Atlanta. Well, back to Atlanta for me, to Atlanta for my wife. And I went to work in the part of the broadcasting business that I've been in since then that involves, among other things, something called public relations. I didn't know what public relations was. I found out real fast. One of the biggest parts of public relations that I found out about and that I liked so much involved a thing called a three martini lunch. I never had drinks at lunch. Had a beer to get going in the morning once in a while, but those three martini lunches I love. Actually, I like five martini lunches, but three do, you know. And then I learned about something else that they had in Atlanta that they didn't have in that other town called happy hour. And that's where you go in a bar and sit down and pay for one drink and they give you two. I knew sometimes I saw two. This time they'd give you two. Some places give you three. And I found out that if you stayed late for lunch and you went early for happy hour, you could, if you stretched it, make the two meet so you didn't even have to go back to work in the afternoon. And frankly, that suited my staff fine because, you see, they sort of liked the boss sometimes that came to work in the morning. But they didn't like the guy that came back from work in the afternoon or back to work in the afternoon after one of those lunches. You see, alcohol had begun to turn on me. I didn't know it. But my best buddy in that bottle was beginning to stick the knife in and twist it. Because it was making personality changes like it always had, but some of them weren't as positive as I thought they used to be. Well, the pattern continued, and the happy hours got longer on the other end, too. Sometimes my wife would be there and drink with me. More often than not, she was not. And I would drink until all hours and completely forget about dinner at home. And I began to wake up in strange places with strange people. I began a lot of nights of not coming home at all. I began the great tradition of the alcoholic of getting up in the morning and scratching my head and going to the window to look out in the carport and see if the car is there. And if it's not, trying to figure out where it is. Only thing worse than looking out in your car not being there is looking out there and part of your car is there. And you don't remember where the rest of it is. I began experiencing the loneliness of drinking in bars and praying for another drunk to come in and sit down so I'd have somebody to talk to. You see, for over 20 years, I had told myself I was a social drinker. Well, folks, I'm going to tell you something. If you've got a drink to be social, then you're not a social drinker. And I did. And I began to experience the loneliness of an alcoholic drinking alone in a bar. I don't think there's any loneliness on the face of this earth that is more painful and more gut-wrenching than that of an alcoholic, lonely in a mob of people. I first started drinking those fancy drinks like martinis and things like that when I got around those clubs because I thought they were classy and romantic. Just, you know, it meant I had class. I used to love the fact that I'd go in bars and in lounges, nice ones in Atlanta, and I'd go in and sit down at the lounge bar with a friend I was trying to impress, and the bartender would walk up and just set my drink right in front of me without even asking what I wanted because he knew. And I thought, that's showing them that I got class. No, it was showing them I was a drunk. I know that today. I didn't notice a lot of life that was going by me. That little girl was getting to be 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 years old. And I didn't notice that she was avoiding her father. I didn't notice that the only look in her eyes was one of fear and of hate and of disgust. I didn't notice that she didn't invite friends over to spend the night anymore because she never knew when Dad's going to come home in a drunken rage and smash the television set or knock out a window or demand that she get up in the middle of the night at 4 o'clock in the morning and clean up her room or some insane thing like that. I didn't notice. Oh, I'd have regrets at something I was told that I did the night before. And I'd get my little girl and I'd say, come on, let's take a walk together. And I'd take her out and we'd go walk. And I'd say, Daddy got a little drunk last night and I'm really sorry, but it's not going to happen anymore, I promise. And you know, for a while she believed it. But after a while, when I take a walk with my little girl and I would tell her those things, I didn't notice that she just had that blank look on her face, because she knew it wasn't true. All the class went out of my drinking, you know, when you plant a car into a steel post on the side of the street and the cops come and they frisk you and put you over the back of the police car and frisk you and put you in the cage in the back and haul you off to jail. There's no class to that. Tried my best to convince that officer that I was not drunk. We got to the station house and he put that breathalyzer on me. He said, .28 is drunk. You ought not be standing here. Got sent to DUI school. At DUI school, a young lady shared with those of us that were attending that she was a recovering alcoholic. She didn't look like one. Somebody asked me, did that get me sober? I said, it did. It took a while because it was 4 more years that I drank and went on with that misbehavior. No class anymore. You know, I told you earlier, it made me glib and made me have quick to think and good humor and all that kind of stuff. Let me tell you something. When you wake up in the morning at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning and you're laying under a bush in Piedmont Park in Atlanta, and when you wake up, you're looking up the nostrils of a policeman's horse. I couldn't think of a one-liner to save my life. No funny line came to me. The marriage continued to fall apart. My wife and I didn't fight that much anymore because we weren't around each other anymore. We did get together at least once a week to have one good knockdown drag out. And she went her way and I went my way. And finally, one night, my wife left. I was sitting at home in my recliner chair, nestled up next to my bottle. And she left. In about 2 hours, she came back. And she walked in the house and she stood in front of me in the recliner chair. And she looked down at me and she said, "Guess where I've been?" And I said, who cares? And she didn't say anything. She did something very strange. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked at it, and I looked at her, and I looked back at her, and I said, "I don't know where you've been, but wherever it was, you had a lousy night. If that's all you won." Well, y'all know where she'd been. The story actually goes a little before that. A couple of years before that, that little old wife of mine had gone to an Al-Anon meeting to find out what to do with that drunken so-and-so at home. Only thing wrong is she went to the Al-Anon meeting crocked. And they ticked her off because they suggested she might be in the wrong room. So she left for a couple of years. Well, that night she went back and she explained to me what that white poker chip meant. And I went, "Oh, no." And I let out of a tirade about what I thought about it. And you can just about imagine what that was. And my wife started going every day, every night, sometimes twice a day, more often than not, going to those meetings. I'd say, though, she didn't try to push it on me. She didn't try to make me go. She didn't try to tell me I was an alcoholic. Oh, there were little hints here and there. You know, I'd raise a toilet seat and there's how it works. You know. She knew where I'd see it. Worshipping at the porcelain throne, you know. I stick my arm under my pillow at night, and there's this little pamphlet with all them questions in there. And I'd get to about the fourth one and wad that thing up and throw it. But something started happening at home. All of a sudden, my sparring partner wouldn't fight anymore. She just walk off. Leave me standing there. She was losing it. Finally, it happened. One afternoon, she came in. She says, I've never asked you to go to an AA meeting with me. I went, oh, God, here it comes. She said, I'm going to get a 90-day chip tonight, and I'd like for you to come see me get it. And I said no, and she said yes, and I said no, and she begged, and we finally, I said, okay, I'll go on one condition. I go in my car so I can get out of there and get home as soon as that thing's over. Because she was always hanging around going somewhere, she said, having coffee with them. I didn't buy that. I didn't care where she was going, though. She was out of the house and off my back. So I went, drove a couple of miles from where we lived to a little house on the side of Roswell Road in North Atlanta, to a little place called the 8111 Club. Now, I'd passed that house a bunch of times. I mean, look, this is it's a house sitting back up in the trees. I'd passed it a bunch of times, and I thought I ought to get to know the guy that lived there because it looked like he had a party every night. His car's all out there, you know. I went in there that night. And I sat down behind a post right at the back of the room. You know, I didn't want nobody to see me there. I'm going to tell you something. I witnessed the craziest bunch of people I'd ever seen in my life. There was a guy there raised his hand in that meeting. They read a bunch of stuff, you know, kind of like. And the guy raised his hand and he said, I got my third DUI last week. Everybody cracked up. Another guy said, I got two DUIs more than that, and I got arrested for public indecency. And I thought the room was going to fall apart. My mind kept saying, you know, if I could tell them some of the things I've done, I could sound like Richard Pryor. But you know, the thought that went through my mind that night with all that laughter going on in that room is, don't these people know what they are? They've got nothing to laugh about. They're alcoholics. Thank God for that laughter. I was saying to Mary at dinner tonight, I think that laughter is the greatest healer that we've got in this fellowship. I think it's the lotion of life, and we need to rub it on thicker. It was the laughter that brought me back to some sanity in those meetings when I could laugh at some of that insanity of the past instead of crying about it. But at that first meeting, I didn't see nothing to laugh about. Finally, at the end of the meeting, I guess they was through because everybody stood up, and I stood up and started for the door, and somebody grabbed me by the hand from both sides. And they said the only thing that was familiar to me that whole hour, and that was the Lord's Prayer, and we got through. I opened that sliding glass door, and out that door I went and started across that parking lot. You know, I told you I came in my car, so I could get out of there. Got halfway across the parking lot, and all of a sudden I felt something grab me by the shoulder. Felt like a steel vise. Spun me around on my toes, and I found myself looking up into the face of a man that was 7'11". Found out later he's only 6'6", but he looked a lot bigger that night. Oh, I remembered this guy in the meeting. I didn't remember most of those other people saying all those things, but this guy, you know, everybody else in the meeting had said, my name's Joe and I'm an alcoholic, my name's Bob and I'm an alcoholic, my name's Sue and I'm an alcoholic. This guy was different. He'd raised his hand to talk and he says, my name's Floyd and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk. Dear God. This guy stops me in the middle of the parking lot and starts talking. And he's talking to me about drinking moonshine liquor in the mountains of North Georgia. And he's talking to me about getting drunk in the wintertime and falling down on the ground and his face freezing to the ground. And they had the pork. I'm saying, he don't even know who I am. What is he talking about? Of course, I found out later he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. But it's going through my head. I'm a college graduate in this redneck hillbilly is trying to, God, he's crazy. And I'm inching toward my car, and I'm going as fast as I can go, and he's going right along with me. I get to my car, reach for the car door, and he leans against it. People come out of the meeting and they get in their cars and they take off and go home. My wife comes out, looks at me, says, bye, gets in her car and leaves. And then it's me and Floyd in the parking lot. I don't know what all he said that night, but I finally got out of that, got in my car, and I went home. I walked in the back door. My wife started to say something. I threw my hand up and said, don't open your mouth. I went to the refrigerator. I got a handful of ice cubes, picked up one of them big old tall iced tea glasses, threw the cubes in it, filled it up with vodka, and said, when I get through with this, we'll talk. Of course, when I got through with that, I couldn't talk. But I did vow never, ever to go back in that nut house again. And I didn't for a while. And I went further down and further down. I said I never abused my family. Maybe I didn't physically, but I did verbally, I did emotionally. And I still took that little girl and I put her lower than... You see, the only way I could build myself up is tearing everybody else down. And I'd take a walk with that little girl. She was 12 years old then, and I'd say, I know Dad did it again last night. And she had that look on her face. We were to find her diary under a mattress in her room in which she had written how much she hated her father and how she wishes he was dead. But I didn't notice and I didn't care. Finally, on the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a literal week-long blackout. The last week of my drinking, I have very little memory of. But that night, or late that afternoon, I came out of a blackout drunk. And I was sitting in that recliner chair. And in my left hand was an empty bottle. And in my right hand was a .22 pistol, and it was loaded and cocked. And the courage was coming. And the thought going through my mind was, is this all there is? Is this it? Because if this is it, you can have it. And through the fog of that blackout, through the haze of that alcohol stupor, came one line from a great, big, beautiful, wonderful, strapping hillbilly drunk by the name of Floyd. I didn't remember anything else he said that night in that parking lot, but one line. And the line that came back to me that afternoon of July 26, 1982, was when I come to the doors of AA, I expected God to open up the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened up the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was that afternoon could be any closer to the gates of hell on this earth, I don't want to know about it. When I came to AA, I expected God to open up the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And I got in my car, and I drove back to that little house on the hill in the trees, and I walked back in that little back door, and I sat down behind that post in the back of that room. And I don't want you to tell me our God doesn't have a sense of humor, because I peeked around that post. And there, sitting at that front table chair in that meeting, was my wife. I heard more laughter. And at the end of that meeting, took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed a white poker chip into my sweaty palm. And I really thought, kind of like I had said to my wife that night when she brought that one home, that I'd reached about as low a point as I could get. That what I did in walking up to the front of that room and admitting that I was licked was about as low as I could go. It's funny, the paradoxes of this fellowship. Today I know that that admission, that walk I took, is probably the most courageous thing I ever did, and I won the greatest victory that I've ever won in my life by admitting the defeat. I won't cut through some of those early days and go straight to some weeks after I got in there. I heard you people tell me I ought to get a sponsor, among other things. And so I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired, Santa Claus-looking old man that I could find, grandfatherly type, because I figured he'd put his arm around me and say, "You're a good boy, Bill, and you're doing great." And I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. In the years that Doc Crandall was my sponsor, I don't remember him ever telling me one thing I wanted to hear. But he told me a whole lot of what I needed to hear. First thing he said is, "Bill, first thing you do every morning is I want you to get down on your knees and ask your God to keep you sober today." And I said, "Well, Doc, I got a little problem with that. I grew up in church, even taught Sunday school there for a while. But I don't know about this knee business. I believe in prayer, and I'm going to get back." He said, wait, just a minute, Bill. He said, "What's the problem?" I said, I'm just not comfortable with that knee business." He said, "I didn't say anything about you being comfortable." I said, "Doc, I thought this was a program of suggestion." He says, "Bill, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor." That's first clue. I screwed up here. He pointed the steps on the wall and he says, "I want you to go home, sit down, spend a few hours and come back and tell me how those can work in your life." And I went home, I got me a legal pad and I got me two or three sharp pencils and I got me a highlighter and I sat down with that book and I started highlighting and underlining, making some notes, even wrote a few additional paragraphs I felt sure they had inadvertently left out that were very pertinent in my mind. And I went back and sat down ready to talk to Doc. I said, "Doc, I did what you said. I've read this. I've studied it very thoroughly. And let's just start here with step one. Now, as I interpret, that's as far as I got." He said, "You wait a damn minute. I didn't say anything about you going home and interpreting this. It don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing." "Yeah, but Doc, what I think it means is," he said, "son, if you hadn't noticed, it's in English. It says what it means. They even put numbers by it for smart college boys like you." I'd go over to Doc's house after work in the afternoon and say, "Doc, I had a really rough day today and I got something I need to talk to you about. This is going on and this is what's happening and this is, you know, I need some good advice from you." He said, "What step are you working on it?" I'd say, "Oh, Doc, this ain't got nothing to do with steps. This is real life stuff. This is business." He said, go look again." I'd go get that book down, I'd open it up, and I'd read through it, and say, "Well, finally admit it, God for sinners. Doc, ain't got nothing to do with step, but go look again." And I'd go back again and again and again and again, until finally, Doc got it through my head, and I believe today with all my heart that there is nothing, zero, that is going to happen in my life that the answer is not in those steps. It's there. Go look. He also said I ought to quit walking around with a long face all the time. He said, "You're supposed to be happy, joyous, and free." And I believe that today. Because I'm going to take, this is the only time in the whole evening, I'm going to take your inventory. I'm going to tell you that it is my belief with all my heart that if you're not happier today than you've ever been in your life, in sobriety, and you got a hole in your program. Problems in life, you bet, they still come. Times get tough, yeah. But overall, I'm happier than I've ever been in my entire life. And I love nothing better than being in rooms like this. Doc told me very early in my sobriety, he said, you getting in an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to take a drink, you're going to lose. You can't win that argument. That cannot be a topic for discussion. I heard him up here, but I didn't hear him in here. And I had to leave Atlanta on my first business trip to Washington, D.C., and I completely forgot what Doc had told me. My plane had not cleared the ground at Hartsfield International Airport. So my head is saying, 800 miles from home, and nobody up there knows you're in AA. You could tie one on tonight, and by the time you get back Friday, you could have it all. You notice I didn't say have a drink. I don't understand the concept of a drink. I still don't understand. I tell you something. Today, I walk in a restaurant, and I sit down, and I see a guy order a drink and eat lunch and get through and leave, and half that drink is still in that glass. There's something in me today that still wants to chase him out in the parking lot and say, come back in here and finish. I don't understand that, folks. I never will. All the way to Washington on that airplane. Yes, no, you can, you can't. Yes, you can. No, you can't. The disease is talking to me. A plane hits the ground at National Airport in Washington. I get off the plane, into the cab. The race is on in my head. All the way from that National Airport to the Hyatt Regency Hotel on Capitol Hill, the argument rages. I didn't see any of the great monuments or the great buildings. I'm listening to this battle going on up here. Walk into the front door of that gigantic hotel with that huge lobby. My radar spots that bar all the way on the other cross, on the other side. It took me less than 5 minutes to get my bag dropped into my room, check into that hotel, drop my bag, get downstairs, and stand in the door of that bar. And I stood in the door of that bar for about 3 or 4 minutes while that argument raged in my head. You can do it. You can have one. You can just have a few. You can tie one drunk on and Doc said, if I got in that argument, I'd lose, and I'd forgot that, and I lost, because I walked over and I sat down at that bar. And the bartender walked up and stood in front of me and looked at me a second, and he said something real strange. He says, hi there, mister, how about a Coke? Say, what? He said, how about a Coke? He said, I figured by that lapel pin you're wearing there, that's what you'd want. I had forgotten to take off this damned AA pin. He set the Coke down, walked down, served 2 or 3 more people, and came back and stood in front of me again. I'm still sitting there looking at that Coke. He said, you don't have any business in here, do you? He said, you know, when I saw you standing in that door for so long, I thought you were looking for somebody. But when you sat down and I saw that pen you got on, I knew what you were doing. He said, you ain't got any business in here. Where you belong is 2 blocks down the street, upstairs over the hardware store. There's a meeting in 20 minutes. Get the hell out of here. I did. And that night, beside a hotel room in Washington, D.C., beside a bed in a hotel room, I got down on my knees and I said, God, if you went to this much trouble to keep this alcoholic sober tonight, I will never test you again. I stay out of bars. I've got no business in them. I can get Cokes elsewhere. I go to a lot of meetings. Why? Because I need them? You bet. Because I want to be there? You bet. I don't know which ones I go to or which. I don't ask questions anymore. The dearest people in my life I find in these rooms. In November of 1986, my sponsor, Doc, went on a 12-step call and never came home. He and another man went to talk to a young alcoholic who had been suicidal. And Doc had been trying to get him, help him get sober for several years. And the young man was in and out of the fellowship. And that day, in a struggle over a shotgun to try to take it away from the young man, Doc was accidentally shot in the stomach and died on his way to the hospital. He gave his life doing what he loved doing more than anything else, and that's trying to help another drunk get sober. In the twilight hours of that day, I sat in Doc's home as calls came from all over the United States to Doc. He was well known all over the country. And you know, we drunks, we got to one of the best grapevines in the world. The news gets out fast. The calls came in and friends came by, and I sat in his house wringing my hands and said, how can I possibly stay sober without Doc here? How can I go on without the rock that has been there for me and has guided me and has shown me through these steps and who has led me into the realization that I'm not a special alcoholic, that I'm a garden variety drunk? How can I go on without him? And before I knew it, I was surrounded by some of the most wonderful, beautiful sponsorees in the world. And they took me to meetings when I didn't want to go. And they were with me when I most wanted to be alone and refused to let me be. And they loved me and nursed me until I could walk again. Until I could realize, how do I stay sober without Doc? I stay sober the way he did, by doing the things he taught me to do, and that his sponsor before him and his sponsor before him and his sponsor before him, all the way back to the night in May of 1935, when the little broken-down stockbroker and the has-been doctor sat in the gatehouse of that mansion in Akron, Ohio, and said, do you think we might be able to stay sober if we help one another? My granddaddy's sponsor, Doc's sponsor, died a couple of years ago, just 9 days after his 40th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was fond of saying that it is his belief that in 1935 that the Almighty God looked down and said, the lowly alcoholic, the outcast of the world, has suffered long enough. I must give him a way out. And dear God, what a wonderful way he gave us. Each other. And laughter. And tears. And hugs. And fellowship. And occasions like this. That's what I mean when I say, isn't this the most fantastic treatment for a fatal disease? We were the outcasts of the earth. Our treatment could have been to be locked away. And unfortunately for those that didn't find these rooms, that is the fate. But instead of a punishment, we were given the greatest life that any people on earth can live. A week ago today, I took another walk with my little girl. This time, a week ago today, I walked down the aisle with her at her wedding. And after the wedding, at the reception, a little girl had planned for she and the groom to have a dance together. And then for she and her dad to have a dance together. And she wouldn't tell me what the music was that we were going to dance to. She said, I want it to be a surprise. And when they announced the dance, and I walked out onto the dance floor with my little girl in her beautiful flowing white wedding gown, and I put my arms around her, and she looked up into my eyes, and the music started. The words of the song are,
Did you ever know that you're my hero and everything I'd like to be? I can fly higher than eagles. You are the wind beneath my wings. What went through my mind was the healing of this fellowship, the healing of the alcoholic's lives and the lives of those around him. I remember the diary in which she said she wished her dad was dead. And last Saturday she looked into my face with a beautiful smile. And she said, "You know, Dad, if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous, none of us would be here. I think you and Mom would be dead. And I think I would be too, because I couldn't go on living with y'all like that." She's not one of us, but she understands us, because she's lived with us through the horror and the agony. But thank God she's lived through us with us in the recovery. Now, I referred to my wife as my first wife, because you see, I'm not married to the same woman that I was as a drunk. And thank God she's not married to the same man either. In 1982, in December, when the divorce was to be final because she was leaving me, instead of signing divorce papers, my wife and I stood before the same minister that had married us 16 years earlier and renewed our vows and began a new life. And it has been a new and wonderful life. And I love my wife with all my heart. She 12-stepped me in ways she didn't even know, I don't think, into this fellowship. She's been by me all the way these last 9.5 years, and she's right here in front of me tonight, and I love her with all my heart. And last Saturday, the same minister that had married us 25 years ago married our little girl. And she's married to a wonderful boy. I like him a whole lot. There is only one thing about him that's a little weird. We went out to dinner a few months after we first met him, and he ordered a beer. And when we got ready to leave, he left half that beer. And I don't understand that. He even loves going to these meetings with us. I've gone way over, and I'm going to close. But I want to close with a little story that happens to be true. It's a story that happened to me some years ago, back in the 1960s. I was sent as a young network reporter to North Georgia's mountains to cover a great event. The great Carl Wallenda was to take a walk across a place called Tallulah Gorge. Some of you may have been there. It's a great chasm in the earth in the mountains of North Georgia. And they had stretched a cable across that gorge, and the great Wallenda was going to take that mark across. And thousands came from miles around, and I was there as a little network reporter to cover it for a number of stations on radio to describe it. And I was in the hot summer afternoon of that August day, and we stood for over an hour waiting for him to come out for the conditions and the wind to be just right for him to take that walk. I'd done my homework on Wallenda. I knew how great he was. I knew he was one of the greatest tightrope walkers of all times, of the great Wallendas of the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey fame. In a little while, he came out of the trailer that sat at the edge of the gorge, and to the applause of the crowd and his spangles and beads and fancy getup. And he walked to the edge of the crowd and to me and to several other reporters, and as we shoved microphones in his face, and he walked up and began chatting with us. Then he looked at me and he said, "Son, let me ask you something. Do you believe I can walk from here to the other side of that 1,200-foot deep gorge?" I said, "Yes, Mr. Wallenda, I have no doubts that you can. I believe you can do it because you're the greatest tightrope walker of all times." He said, "Do you believe that I can do it pushing that wheelbarrow propped against that tree there?" I said, "Yes, sir, I have no doubts. I'd read all about it. I think there are a lot of people there to see this old man fall to his death, being curiosity, people being what they are." I said, "Yes, sir, I believe you can do it." And then the great Wallenda asked me a critical question. "Do you believe it enough to get in the wheelbarrow?" That's what Alcoholics Anonymous asks of you. Do you believe it works? Did Margaret Redd up here tonight enough to get in the wheelbarrow? It's going to be scary out there sometimes. But it's such a beautiful, beautiful view. And it gets better, and it gets better, and it gets better. You see, I don't just have a book to go by. This is my owner's manual. I've got the 57 years of experience of all those millions of alcoholics that have come before me to say, it gets better and better. My granddaddy's sponsor, when he died a little over 2 years ago until his 40th birthday, and I'm sure to our celebrants tonight to the 49th birthday would agree that it gets better every day. It gets happier. It gets more wonderful. But it requires a commitment. You know, we come in here, all we say is, all we want you to do is change your life, change how you act, where you go, who you see, how you think, how you react. That ain't much. But then they say one day at a time, and that helps. I want to close tonight by sharing with you a quick prayer. It's the prayer I prayed every time I pick up another year's medallion. It's the prayer I pray when I look into my wife's eyes and I see love and trust. It's the prayer I pray as I drive along the Chattahoochee River on my way to work in the morning and watch the sun come up through clear eyes. It's the prayer I pray when I see a crowd of wonderful, happy, joyous drunks like this in this room tonight. And it's the same prayer that I pray when I looked into my little girl's eyes last Saturday afternoon and saw the laughter and the smile and the love and the respect. And the prayer is simply this. Dear God, thank you. Because I almost missed all this. God, love you all, and thank you very much.